It's time for Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, folks, once again, it's time for another edition of Valley Edition. And here in the fog that envelops downtown Palmer, and maybe parts of the rest of the world, I'm happy to welcome two people into the studio. The first, Terry Snyder. Welcome, Terry.
Good foggy morning.
And also, Mark Kelsey. Welcome, Mark.
Good morning, Mike.
And then on the phone, Zaz Hollander. Welcome, Zaz.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
Well, we have a number of pieces that we could refer to as important topics this week. One I'd like to begin with is perhaps the follow-on to a piece that you, Zaz, did dealing with hospice back at the beginning of the week. Maybe just a quick summary and anything that has happened or developed since that time.
We got a very well-reported story from Kaiser Health News. They spent almost a year, I think, reporting a national story on hospice negligence and how often sort of end-of-life care that's expected to bring kind of peace and solace and a way to die at home is a disappointment and is sort of difficult, far more difficult than I think most people expected. There are plenty of really good hospice providers and hospice scenarios, but what they found was, I think it was almost a quarter of the cases that they looked at. There are more than 4,000 hospice providers around the country, and there were issues with almost a quarter of the situations that were, there were reports of problems. And so all I did was, they had focused fairly heavily on a woman from Wasilla, Mrs. Martin, who her husband, who was a fairly well-known family practice doc out of Wasilla, Dr. Bob, Robert Martin, his last week of life was very difficult for their family because of some protocols at Mat-Su Regional that have since been changed and under an administrator who's no longer there. But to be very clear, I basically piggybacked on another two reporters, a very good story that we linked to very high up in mine, Kaiser Health News reporting, and just focused on this one local case where the Martin family had some real trials in trying to get end-of-life care for a physician. And, you know, Mrs. Martin even told me that Pat Martin said that, you know, there was one scenario where she was crushing pills for her husband and administering them with a syringe she found in his bag. And, you know, most of us don't have that access, you know, as difficult as it was for her, and it was very difficult. You know, she'd worked in a lab, she had a medical background, and she'd been married to a doctor for a long time, and she's also kind of a resilient, savvy person, but that most people in her situation would have had even more trouble. And, you know, most of the problems that she says she dealt with, you know, the attending physician, she had to deal with the hospice program once she signed the contract to go into hospice, she said. So she, you know, it was days before a certain painkiller that she wanted would come, and part of the issue was the hospice physician worked nights, and so he slept during the day, which isn't a problem. If you're seeing him at night, you want him to be sleeping, but there was a backup physician, but some of the nurses didn't know that. I mean, there was just not a clear train of communication in the hospice program at that point, certainly for her care, for her husband's care, and for, I think, at least three or four other patients that the state looked at when they came in to do an audit after she filed a complaint. So it was not an isolated incident. I think that was important. And they also found that her experience, they interviewed hospital staff, and basically this audit backed up her contention that this isn't a disgruntled patient, you know, making noise about something that didn't happen. The audit did credit her report and found there were several other people who dealt with kind of varying degrees of similar problems. As I said, the hospital since then made several significant changes to their hospice program.
So, you know what I find interesting about your story, Zaz, is that this was a medical provider. And it's always been my experience with medical providers that they get some pretty good care at the end of life just because of who they know and their connections and their deep ingrained in the community. And I just find it kind of stunning that he there wasn't an array of people outside the hospital she couldn't have called to say, hey, I'm not getting answers. Can you step in? I don't know. Does that, it just seems odd. Does that seem odd to anybody else?
It seems odd, and it makes me wonder, Zaz, how much of this is, you know, years in the making? Is this, you know, a gradual breakdown in the system? What was revealed in the Kaiser story?
I mean, part of the issue is the kind of lack of accountability, that there is not a lot of consistent oversight on hospice programs. And there is, I think, less reporting than, say, if you, you know, if you're in a hospital setting and something goes wrong, there's room for, you know, medical malpractice. And in this setting, you know, these are, in general, if your loved one is in hospice care, you know, you're dealing with what's about to be a death in the family. And I think most people in that setting, and once the death happens, just don't have it in them to file a complaint, to go through the system. I think that's another part of the problem. And, you know, these aren't nonprofits, you know. But this report found that there was more oversight in assisted living than there is in hospice.
Wow. And that's not saying very much.
Yeah.
So this is a lack of personnel issue at the core, is it not?
I don't know that, Mark. And again, this was not my original reporting. I went and interviewed Pat Martin, but the larger story is Kaiser Health News, and they deserve all the credit. But a personnel issue, I don't know. I mean, here at Matt Sue, there you know, that there was a backup doctor who could have been called and was eventually called to make a prescription for methadone, but. You know, and it was a time of year where there wasn't heavy staffing and nurses were on vacation or were on jury duty. But, you know, sure, if they've got a deeper bench, then that isn't as big a problem. Certainly we all work for companies or agencies that are aware of holidays coming up and try to make staffing changes to meet that demand.
Yeah, I know I've heard in the community, too, some criticism about the amount of transitional physicians and care that they use at Matsu as opposed to people that actually live here, and that might be part of it too. And it's shouldn't be any big surprise that there is just the whole science of palliative care is lacking, and we're getting older, and more of us are, you know, less of our family members are around to take care of us. And it's something I know the American Cancer Society, even AARP, and other organizations are trying to be more visible. Actually, the Native Hospital in Anchorage probably has, I think, one of the only palliative care teams that really do have a good communication and does a pretty good job for end of life. And I don't know how a hospice runs into that, but it's just a problem everywhere.
So what we were also talking about, and I think it's important to remember, and I took from your article, this is a story over a rather lengthy period of time. The Dr. Martin portion of it occurred about 3 years ago. There have been changes, as you pointed out, Zaz, in terms of management, development, attention, maybe in response to the broader study that Kaiser did. And I try to keep that in mind to say probably the follow-up, if we can over the next week or two, is to check with people in a little more depth to say, what's the present experience with hospice and what has been recognized, where is it going? And that would be the interesting thing, whether it's Kaiser and or we here, being able to get a better picture of the present status of things.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay. I know that you are working on another story upcoming, and I have a announcement that's been posted in our window here at the studio about a missing young man. Do you have any comment about that?
He is a 30-year-old man with some mental health diagnoses. He's been diagnosed schizophrenic, and I believe also suffers from manic depression and doesn't always take his meds and apparently wasn't taking his meds, but his family is very concerned. He's got, I think, 12 brothers and sisters, And they are concerned. His one of his brothers is coming up from Lower 48 to not only help look for him, but to try to encourage law enforcement to shift from missing persons mode to a criminal investigation. His family doesn't think he's just missing, in part because he doesn't. This is very unusual behavior for him, and you know, there are a number of aspects of that that have them concerned. The troopers, as far as I know, and again, I'm just starting to report this story, but they consider him a missing person because they don't have an indication otherwise. The family is saying, well, we can't get you, you know, documentation because we don't have power of attorney, and the only agency that could get this documentation is the troopers. And so it's kind of a closed loop right now, and so I think they're hoping for some more attention in hopes of finding out what happened to him.
Okay.
Do they have any, you know, guesses or suspicions about the cause? What caused this guy to go missing?
Not that I've heard.
Is foul play suspected?
Well, that's why they want a criminal investigation opened, I think.
Just to see if there is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw another Facebook post, I think yesterday, about a missing 40-ish woman in Palmer, too. Is that?
Yeah, I saw that, too. I don't know what that's related to, and I certainly have no indication that's related to this.
Okay. So if someone were to have any information, and the gentleman in question is very large, as I understand, 300-pound plus, mm-hmm. And there some is the best, I guess the best response would be to the troopers, or is this the best way to?
I think so. I don't have the poster in front of me.
Okay. All right. With that, let's shift to something that happened also over in Wasilla not so long ago, and that is the banning of plastic bags. Now, once that happened, I know the lead up to this topic caused a lot of discussion. The plastic bag ban has been made official. It'll take effect in some time in its own way. I had an opportunity to speak with the city manager here in Palmer, and interestingly enough, when we walk through the detail of all of this, we can say that the City of Palmer Council at the present time doesn't have on the docket anything that they're about to do in this regard. More waiting still. You know, the original thought was Wasilla will do something, and then we have Palmer and Houston and the borough, and they could look at it. But when you look at the practicalities of it, you realize that we have the City of Wasilla, with its very large dispersal of retail establishments, big box stores. And then we have also the really interesting question of whether this will become really a corporate expansion. In other words, we have Cars and we have Fred Meyer in both Wasilla and Palmer. And if the one gets rid of plastic bags, Fred Meyer's and Wasilla, for example, well, maybe it doesn't require the Palmer City Council for doing anything. It would be that those two big, which are the two largest entities here in the City of Palmer, if they take care of things, then we have a very small number of plastic bags and businesses that are dealing that way. Maybe that would require an action, maybe not. So that this leaves the City of Palmer and the borough actually looking at a small proportion of the bags borough-wide. Any thought about any of that, Mark?
Well, certainly from a distribution standpoint, on behalf of Cars and Fred Meyer, for example, it makes sense that they would want to make the drops uniform between the two stores. I don't know what kind of history there is in other places, but it seems like a reasonable thing to think that would happen unassisted.
Right. Terry, you're sort of looking
I'm
here.
I'm not sure either. I think you'd have to look at the history of how this affected other areas. I mean, there are a lot of cities in the lower 48 that have the bans where the cities are closed and one does and one doesn't. There's an awful lot of plastic bags blow around during the wind, and it's hard for me to think that they're all coming from just the Palmer, those two Palmer stores now.
Do you think it requires a council action?
It doesn't require it. I think it's probably the right thing to do. But whether it requires it, it's sort of the way that the Palmer City Council operates is to kind of wait and see how it works out before they take action. And it doesn't surprise me that they're going to do it that way. But whether it'll have the overall effect just by those two stores, and does that mean that Anchorage Cars and that Safeway, they and Fred Meyer, they also do it because it's all coming to Alaska, or do they just send all their plastic bags that they have on hand to Palmer because we're the only one without the thing? It's kind of hard to say, and I think really to answer that, you'd have to see how it played out in other areas.
Right. Okay. All right.
I hope somebody's looking into that.
Sure. Well, another piece of information that came in my discussion with the Palmer City manager earlier today was that in terms of finalizing the budget for the city of Palmer, which will be done in December, they're a little ahead of things. You get a first indication of how things are going in the valley. Recently, there's been an article, I think the Alaska Dispatch News carried one, that suggested that the valley was the bright spot in Alaska in terms of employment, in terms of a variety of factors that would suggest that we're doing okay here as compared to other parts of Alaska. And what I heard from the city manager seemed to support that idea in terms of what has been coming in as far as sales money, et cetera. Palmer is doing okay. It's not growing, but it's not declining. And that's an interesting, I think, an interesting aspect. The three of you, have you noticed changes in the economy here, personally, one way or the other? Mark?
I have not. I'm curious if that study, pinpointed any sector or sectors that are leading the charge.
Well, healthcare, government employment, service sector, and for that matter, and so on. So, yeah, we're not seeing the kind of somewhat of a decline that's occurring in Anchorage. Terry?
So I've heard from a few merchants they are seeing it. People that are not spending as heavily as they were. I've heard that from a couple of different merchants, a little surprised, are starting to feel the pain of it. I'm curious, did he talk about what the receipts were for the fair, if they were same?
Well, they were roughly the same, in other words, flat. The numbers that we have coming out of the Alaska State Fair indicate a slight decline in the number of people who went. I don't have the specifics, but the amount of money, you have to look at really about three different areas. You have rides and things of that sort, games of chance. You have the big performances of the events that occur there, and then you have, of course, food. and I think one or another has gone down a little bit, the other's gone up, so that roughly in terms of sales tax revenue that flows to the city as a result of the fair being there, roughly the same. So it's not been, wasn't any big decline. So
fewer people spent a little more money.
Yeah, that could be.
Interesting.
So, again, the preliminary sense is if we were looking at a really big downturn, and you would have seen that perhaps as some kind of a bellwether, unless people were just saying we're saving it for the fair. I'm not sure. Zaz, any comment from Zaz first?
I don't know if we're expecting a really big turn down. I do think that I've heard a little bit of what Terry's hearing. I've also heard that we're kind of getting overbuilt. There was a real housing, sort of a surprising housing boom the last couple of years, surprised the school district. In areas out by Reddington, but also by Tenino Elementary, and I just wonder. I mean, unless it's, I think as we probably reported, we're kind of our loss, our gain is Anchorage's loss. But the fact that a lot of the jobs are in government, if it's borough government, then there's also a flip side in terms of paying property taxes without a source of manufacturing. That if you're not working in those government jobs, I mean, I haven't had a raise in a long time. You know, I think the private sector is not as healthy.
Okay, Terry?
Yeah, and you know, I think we also have to, a lot of statistics are looking back, not, I mean, that's really what it's based on. That's what Neil Fried and the Labor Department is looking on. And they're looking at the time when a lot of those capital projects were still going on, and there has now not been a capital budget for a couple of years. Now, we have one in Palmer because we have the sewer project going on, and they're doing a couple of little ones, but just not those capital projects. And I got to believe that once those are, we really hit the bottom of those, and everybody's, they may be, you know, have money now, and we have a bad snowfall, so, you know, there's no snowplowers out there. There's so many little variables, and then that constant no solution from Juno, no certainty from Juno of what's going forward, whether there's going to be, you know, an income tax, whether there's not going to be an income tax, whether we're going to have a sales tax. Plus, we're having a big tax overhaul with this nationally, too. So I just have to, I'm usually, you know, I'm not usually Debbie Downer, but I've got to say that there are just a lot of unknowns out there. And maybe that it just, the day of reckoning hasn't come for those yet because we're looking back.
So looking ahead and looking at the now, Terry, you've managed to spend a little bit of time looking at what's happening in Juneau. Have you seen anything that gives you a sense of direction?
I've tried to listen to some of the crime hearings, and they just make my head hurt. It's just, it's still a lot of bloviating and running, basically. I just don't know how they're going to get there on this unless they really put aside their political, the next election, and get down to it. There's so much misinformation out there about SB 91. There's so much misinformation about SB 54, which was supposed to fix it. I again, maybe it's just my day-to-day not to be optimistic, but I just don't know how they do that. And the Senate is, you know, talking about revenue and interviewing the revenue piece of it and the permanent fund people, but I don't see where they're getting any closer to changing their feet that are stuck where they are either. But maybe Mark has different views.
Well, no, I think you're probably... I think your tone is proper. The Juneau Empire reported today that the House, the Finance Committee, passed SB 54 out on a 9-2 vote.
Oh.
And said there could be a full House vote as soon as the weekend.
Wow.
But it did talk about, you know, this could still, these variable things could still happen. And, well, plus the big thing is, even if the full House does vote on it, it's still significantly different from the Senate version. So there would have to be a conference committee and, you know, further haggling and compromise. So we may not be close.
So when you say pass that out, pretty much the form that, well, what form? Any details?
I think the biggest piece of it, or at least the piece reported in the current story, is about increasing penalties. For theft, especially increasing the threshold for felony theft, and that I think was a sticking point in the Senate already. There are other the story talked about other smaller, you know, technical fixes, but things like penalties seem to be where one version is different from the other.
Okay.
Thoughts?
That you guys are on it.
Well, I think also Thanksgiving's going to get in the way here pretty soon, and I can't imagine any legislator that does want to be down there during that period. So they're going to run up against that. Plus, you know, that you can't be raising money when you're in session, and that end of the year money is pretty enticing to people to be out being at as many events as they can be seen at, so they can, you know, put those, get their coffers filled up before they start again in January. So that's the ticking time bomb.
And, of course, this special session doesn't have a near end time. It can go on for quite a while through these holiday times.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see if it were to go on and just continue on into January. Are we looking at a year-round legislature? Maybe just do that. Yeah, maybe just do that. And
can't seem to do anything to prevent it.
So, and I have not heard any more said about the proposal to reduce salaries of legislators. I know that was something that the committee that looks at the
They passed it out, didn't they? And now it's up to the legislators to do something different.
If they either have to, there's the time frame for accepting it, basically letting it happen, or come up with a different version.
I don't know. I know that there was talk of reducing per diems or special session
the board.
Per diems.
It's quite a significant cut.
This could be $20,000 a legislator. It's
significant.
Given amount. Okay. Well, folks, we've come to about that time, once again, the end of another edition of Valley Edition. And I want to thank Zaz Hollander for calling in. Thank you, Zaz.
You're very welcome. Have a good week, everybody, and or weekend.
All right. And I want to thank Terry Snyder. Thank you, Terry, for coming to the studio.
Ditto. Have a good weekend.
And I want to thank Mark Kelsey for coming in. You drove the longest distance, I think.
And glad to be a part of it.
All right. We'll be back again next week for another edition of Valley Edition.
You've been listening to Valley Edition, a weekly panel discussion on current issues in the Mat-Su Valley, moderated by Mike Malevsky. Valley Edition is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of hosts or guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, this station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions about this program, email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.